This is Renegade Broadcasting. Everybody, happy Wednesday. Let's finish up our pygmies discussion from yesterday. The natural follow-up to the giants thing. Clearly, our history is much more different, much more varied than what we've been told in many ways. In many ways. Imagine, guys, they even have to suppress this. They even have to suppress ancient history. A lot of suppression. In fact, I'll be following this discussion up. Well, not right away, but one of the upcoming shows here soon. I'm going to be talking about some more mysteries from ancient Egypt. I was thinking of doing this particular show as part of a series, but no, I think I'm going to present this, something I worked on last week. I'll present that, soon. Probably not until, I don't know, Friday or Monday or something. But I will be doing another series on ancient Egypt coming up as well. Somewhat related to this, but anyway. So much suppression. It's disgusting. It's not a matter of how much are we being lied to. It's much easier to ask, how much are we being told the truth about? And it ain't a hell of a lot. So it's you know, easier to answer that question than it is to answer how much are we being lied to about. And how much are we being told the truth about? Well, let's see. They tell us the sky's blue. I think we can confirm that pretty easily enough. I was going to say death and taxes, but no, that's a lie too, because taxes aren't guaranteed. They're a lie. Income tax, anyway. Well, it's guaranteed if you don't want a SWAT team at your door. So I guess that is guaranteed. Yeah, maybe that isn't a lie. You better pay it or we're going to rape and pillage you and rake you over the coals and roast you over an open fire, even though we don't have any legal right to do so. But it is still guaranteed. Don't pay and you'll get a visit. Seriously, guys, other than that, everything they tell us is a lie. There's really, really nothing that we've been told that either isn't a complete lie or at least, you know, doused enough with lies so that in the end you wind up on the wrong side of the fence. Sometimes they do throw a little truth in there, but it's so skewed with lies that truth comes attached with that you might as well just call the whole thing, write the whole thing off as a lie. My God, it's unbelievable. And it doesn't matter what subject you're talking about, you know, whether it's religion, politics, history, science, you name it. There's no exceptions. Every field has the little status quos. And, the professors in that field, they know that they have to play the game. They step out of line, and the pressure that's put on them is tremendous. A lot of times, you know, for example, their job is threatened because the college gets a phone call from Washington telling them, hey, you know, shut this guy up or you're not going to get your grant money this year. Well, there you go, right there. But, you know, they already know before they open their mouth, which is why they don't open their mouth for the most part. Very, very few are willing to do that. Are willing to take that that risk, you know. It's so pathetic, guys. But like I said, until you've experienced it firsthand, you really can't appreciate just how sleazy this system is. You know, what I went through with my discovery about the you know, the Trinity Doctrine, little did I know that was just the tip of the iceberg. Oh, I thought I found the big one. Oh, Jesus Christ. Nope. I hadn't even put the key in the ignition yet. That was only the beginning of a long journey. And, you know, like I said, it's probably just as well that the truth came in piecemeal fashion for me, because I probably would have died from a heart attack a long time ago. From the shock of it all, my God, the whole frickin' mess is a lie. You know, the Bible itself. I think my belief in the Bible kept my head on straight to get me through, you know, the shock of finding out how corrupt my church was and you know, leaving the whole thing. That turned my world upside down. It did. It was a bitter pill to swallow. If I had found out that the Bible itself was horse shit, yeah, I probably, you know, that's how much they get you sucking on the pacifier. That's how much they make you dependent, incapable of standing on your own two feet. They program you from the time you're young to you know, to suck the breast milk and become so dependent on it. You don't question anything. You know, this is the truth. So, you know, that's what I clung to through it all. Well, yeah, I lost my church. I'm not going to be a part of this anymore. But at least I've got my Bible to stand on, you know. An artificial foundation, you know, full of cracks, full of holes. But it somehow, you know, it got me through that little placebo pill, got me through. And like I said, guys, as much of a poison as that goddamn book is, it's probably just as well that that so many people cling to it. I'd like to see a day when people can finally put that thing in the incinerator. But there are so many fragile minds out there. I once had one myself. That to take it away from them, I think a lot of them would go stark raving mad. They'd probably jump off the Brooklyn Bridge or go postal and go on a shooting spree. Seriously. That's pathetic, but it's true. Which is why I've said before, I'll say it again, be very careful when you request my notes on the Bible. You know, be very careful who you share that with. And how you share it, you know, don't just dump it on their laps. You got to feel a person out, know what you're dealing with, know if that person is, you know, potentially suicidal. Jesus Christ, if you even have the slightest hint that they are, don't even bother. Talk about politics or something. Don't even touch religion. Or if they're in their senior years, you know, my God, why wreck it for them at that point? That might do them in prematurely. Bring them to an early grave. You don't want to do that. It's really sad that, you know, most religio dupes work that way, but they do. They do. It's a very sensitive thing, and, you know, be careful. You know, this kind of truth is toxic for a lot of people. They just aren't capable of handling it. So you got to deal with them like little children, because unfortunately, that's what they are. That's how their minds work. They might as well have been MK Ultra. In a sense, they have been, actually. And so you will traumatize them if you break their programming. Pathetic, isn't it? That's what this poison does to people. All propaganda is poison. But my God, man, when it comes to religion, nothing is more potent. Nothing does more damage to the mind. Anyway, back to our notes here. During the 1900s, when Vanuatu was known as New Hebrides, sizable pygmy tribes were first reported throughout northeastern Santo. So again, we're still looking at modern times here. Did you know there were this many pygmy races scattered around the world? Still living. Although, understand, they're still taller than some of the ones we're going to be looking at that are now extinct. But, you know, they're in the 4.5 foot range. There were some guys that were significantly shorter than that, as we're going to see. Anyway. Tribes of very short people are also found in the mountains of New Guinea. There's been several instances of records, making reference to that. In 2008, the remains of at least 25 miniature humans, if you will, who lived between 1,000 and 3,000 years ago, were found on the islands of Palau in Micronesia. The Plains Indians of North America have legends that talk of a small people like 8-year-olds, they say, who once lived in the rocks and cliff dwellings of Yellowstone. The Crow Indians likewise speak of small men and women who, quote, created many of the paintings and rock carvings and had a strong role in our tribal taboos and religion, they say. The Lewis and Clark expedition related that they had camped out by a hill one night near the Tetons. This hill turned out to be a man-made mound, according to their recollections, and the Dakota Indians told them that this mound was known as the Mountain of the Little People, otherwise known as Spirit Mountain, but they called it the Mountain of the Little People, that the little people had created it. The Cherokee also talk of a race of little people who had blonde hair and blue eyes. That's interesting, because a lot of the legends of giants talk about them as having had blonde hair and blue eyes. Very interesting. Another possibility to consider when you talk about these, ancient peoples of both large and small stature, another possibility to consider is genetic tampering, deliberate genetic tampering. Is that, or was that, a factor with this? No, if you have your head up your ass and believe mainstream academia that the ancients were ignorant about genetics and were too stupid to have done such modifications, Yes, if you accept the fact that mainstream academia is full of shit and they lie to us about just about everything, and you recognize that the ancients were at least just as smart, if not smarter, than we are. So there's a possibility. Why would they have done that? Well, that's another story. It's anybody's guess. We know that modifications were done, though. lower tech ones, for example, skull elongation. You know, they did that simply by placing boards on an infant's head. Very sinister. I don't imagine it was very comfortable, but, you know, that's what they would do. We know that because some records have survived that tell us that. When the skulls of these infants were malleable, you know, the bones weren't connected and solidified yet, they would place these boards connected with screws that they would tighten. And as the child's head would grow and develop and the bones would start to fuse, they would fuse together in this elongated shape. You know, they did it for, well, one reason being that, you know, it was a way of distinguishing the royalty from the common plebs. But also, it's possible they did it because, you know, the brain would be larger. Perhaps it gave them, you know, a bit more intelligence than the average person. Who knows? But, you know, there were modifications done. It wasn't genetic, of course. It wasn't something you passed on, whereas giantism or dwarfism was genetic. Was it genetic because these were just, you know, extinct races of people? Or was it genetic because, you know, they were bred that way? Genetic modifications were made so that the offspring would produce others of that same stature. Who knows? Who knows? Just throwing that out there as a possibility. Anyway, but, you know, my contention is that's probably just something natural, probably, you know, just extinct races that don't exist anymore. Just like you have, you know, extinct animal species that don't exist, plant species that were wiped out. You know, that's probably what went on here. And they were wiped out. We have quite a few legends that have survived to our day that talk about how these giants were pursued and destroyed. The pygmies, for the most part, actually, they weren't wiped out. We still have remnants of them here and there. They're a little bit taller than they once were. But the giants were hunted into extinction for reasons I mentioned yesterday. They were formidable, probably resistant to tribal control. Anyway, Tennessee newspapers in the 19th century. It's funny, I was just corresponding with someone in email this morning. And, you know, they were commenting, yeah, this is fascinating how the earth was a paradise in the distant past compared to what it is today. Yeah, its physical environment was paradisal. You know, you had, more oxygen in the atmosphere. You had, the absence of seasonal changes. You know, it was relatively warm, on a global scale. You had a greenhouse effect in place. All year round, you had a constant growing season. And then I commented that, you know, aside from all that, the main reason it was a paradise is there were no Jews back then. That would have made it a paradise right there alone, wouldn't it? Anyway, as I was saying, Tennessee newspapers in the 19th century reported finds of small human skeletons in Sparta, Smith, and White counties. Fine engraved figures were also found, and the arms of 3-foot skeletons were found to have been folded over the chest as part of the manner in which they were buried. So there you go. Tennessee had both giants and pygmies. Quite a few giants were exhumed from Tennessee mounds. We have record of that from the Smithsonian. But now we find that there were also some pygmies that lived in the area. So, you know, did the giants live in conjunction with the pygmies? Imagine the contrast of the two civilizations living in close proximity to one another. It's very strange. In Mexico's Hill of the Sacred Stones lie some interesting subterranean ruins known as pygmy tunnels. Some of these tunnels are well known and well explored, but some are quite enigmatic and have not yet to this day fully been explored. The first of them was discovered in 1932, but wasn't explored they weren't explored until a year later, 1933. And, you know, you can look these up online. There's pictures of them and whatnot. This first tunnel was found to be narrow, only 20 inches high and 25 inches wide. How do they even carve that out, let alone meander their way through it? Explorers had to, you know, inch through the narrow passage for 195 feet, finally coming to a tomb with a skeleton, an incense burner, and various funeral urns, a pygmy skeleton, of course. So obviously the tunnels were carved by miniature humans. There were also ornaments of jade, turquoise, and stone, and a few pearls. A blockage just beyond this find necessitated digging a 25-foot shaft past the impasse. As they wormed along the next stretch, they found even smaller passages, no more than a foot high, branching off the main tunnel. It got to a point where, you know, they couldn't even proceed any further. So it's obvious these were dug, just like we found, you know, large artifacts backing up the idea of ancient giants. We found small artifacts, or in this case, small tunnels, obviously dug by small humans. Anyway, leading down into one of these tunnels was a tiny flight of steps. Obviously, if you've got tiny stairs, you had to have tiny people. The stairs were built to accommodate small people, most likely built by small people. At a distance of 320 feet from the main entrance, the archaeologists found another skeleton, and a few yards beyond this, at the edge of the northern terrace of the Great Plaza, the tunnel came to an abrupt end. So maybe they stopped mid-construction. Civilization, you know, vanished, as we know happened with the Maya. It just came to an end. When archaeologists first started exploring Mayan sites, you know, back in the mid to late 19th century, they were shocked to discover that a lot of their temples had been abandoned so quickly that, you know, they found bowls and you know, other eating utensils just dumped haphazardly in the streets. Tools were left on the steps of temples, you know, as they began to dig. They would find tools that were just randomly left there, buried under, you know, several feet of dirt and other debris because of the ensuing centuries. But nevertheless, this stuff was just left there. They must have literally dropped what they were doing and fled. Anyway, the excavators' initial guess was that the pygmies that created this construction had discovered a drainage, or the archaeologists concluded they had discovered a drainage system when they first saw these tunnels. But then the discovery of the small set of steps caused them to abandon this conclusion And then, of course, the small skeletons. And they realized, you know, it must have been pygmies that created this. Were these pygmy tunnels actually built by a race of ancient Mexican pygmies? Well, we've seen them in so many other places around the world. And of course, right in North America, not too far away. So, yeah, why should we harbor any doubt? Anyway, these modern pygmies, or what we've talked about so far, for the most part, have been modern pygmies. They're very interesting and anomalous, but nothing compares to the ancient pygmies that inhabited the island of Flores in Indonesia in the remote past, to which we'll now turn our attention. These pygmies are most astonishing because of their, you know, very unusually small size. Anyways. So yeah, let's take a look at this. In 2003, a skeleton of a human under 3 feet tall was discovered on the island of Flores, which was dated to have allegedly lived over 30,000 years ago. Well, again, guys, you know, toss a coin basically as to whether or not you accept that date. Who knows? Who knows? I don't trust their dating methods. In fact, many scientists admit that any archaeological finds over 5,000 years old, you know, the dating that's assigned to them are highly questionable, are open for debate. Because of the short half-life of carbon-14, carbon-14 is fairly reliable. There's problems there too, but it is, you know, the theory behind it is pretty sound. And, you know, it has proved for the most part to be accurate, to be reliable, but not for things that are known or at least suspected to be over 5,000 years old. That's where the problem arises. These pygmy finds are indeed a good example of that. They are believed to be older than 5,000 years old. So to say they're 30,000, who knows? They could be 60,000. They could be only 10,000, or 6,000. You know, who knows? Who knows? I don't put much stock, though, when they say, oh, this site is 30,000, this site is 100,000. You know, it's just fairy tales. And of course, that situation gets magnified exponentially worse when we're dealing with petrified remains, you know, fossils, dinosaur bones and whatnot. Forget it. Don't even waste your time. Make up your own dates if you want. You have free rein to do so because their dating is just laughably ridiculous, as I've said before. You cannot tell how old biological materials are when no more biological material exists in the fossil that you're examining. All you're looking at are the minerals that have replaced the original biological materials. You can't date those minerals and claim that that tells you how long ago the biological materials existed. What a joke. And yet that's how science works today, so-called science. All right, guys, sure, take care, guys.
I think there's a resurgence of anti-Semitism because at this point, in time, Europe has not yet learned how to be multicultural. And I think we're going to be part of the throes of that transformation, which must take place. Europe is not going to be the monolithic societies that they once were in the last century. Jews are going to be at the center of that. It's a huge transformation for Europe to make. They are now going into a multicultural mode, and Jews will be resented because of our leading role. But without that leading role and without that transformation, Europe will not survive.
Guys, welcome back. So anyway, these pygmy finds, first discovered in 2003, involved a human under 3 feet tall. At first, many scientists claimed that this skeleton represented a freak of nature, you know, some genetic mishap. However, over the ensuing years, many other small skeletons have been found in a nearby cave, clearly revealing that there was indeed an entire species of Homo florentiensis, as they call this find now, that thrived in the area in the remote past. There was a whole race of these pygmies in that height range, you know, from a little under 3 feet to a little over 3 feet, on the average, about 3 feet tall. Can you imagine fully grown adults, 3 feet tall? Their skulls were the size of grapefruits, and they're said to have had bulging eyes. This species of pygmy was so small, in fact, that it prompted Peter Brown, head of the research team that first discovered Homo floresiensis, to make this comment, quote, "If you told me an alien spacecraft had landed on Flores, I would have been less surprised than by this discovery." Christopher Chippendale, mentioned him, I think, yesterday. Gotta love that name. Curator of the University of Cambridge Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology, was quoted in the March 2005 edition of Discover Magazine as saying, and I think that's where I mentioned him before. I quoted this same quote when we talked about giants. But anyway, here it is in this context, because he also mentions these little people here. He said, "The discovery of Homo floresiensis, the miniature-sized humans from the remote island of Flores, is genuinely unique. Never before has a fundamentally different kind of human being been found who lived at the same time as our own species, Homo sapiens. That raises an intriguing question. Is there truth, after all, in the many stories from many lands of other humans, extra large or extra small, living in the mountains or in the forests, which have been dismissed as myths and fantasies?" Yeah, is there truth to them? Science, for the most part, guys, almost without exception, completely writes off ancient legends, ancient folklore. You know, they don't pay any attention to it at all. Because, and it's true, very often some of these ancient legends, or a good many of them, are embellished with hyperbole, you know, exaggerations. They completely write it off and say there's nothing there to be gained. Well, that's just not true. I'll even argue that, you know, the Bible shouldn't be entirely ignored. There is a lot of horse shit in there, and for the most part, it, you know, there's no credibility to the thing, but there are some, you know, important points therein. You can't totally write it off because the writers of the thing did plagiarize from reliable sources, and so some truth did slip in there. In my book, An Alternative View of the Distant Past, for example, I quote from the Bible as yet another reference among so many other ancient records that I cite, you know. Those records are also filled with hyperbole too, but there are glimmers here and there of truth to be gleaned from these sources. So you can't entirely write it off. The Talmud is another example. As full of horseshit as that goddamn collection of nonsense is, there's some good, you know, references in there as well, especially about the not so great Jesus. There's a lot of very revealing statements in there that, if you ask me, are far more reliable than what's in the goddamn New Testament. Anyway, and why? Simply because the New Testament was written with a bias. The Jesus worshipers wrote it, so naturally they're going to flavor it with all kinds of BS. So he comes out looking not only squeaky clean, but why? They make him almost divine. Trinitarians will tell you he is divine. He's God himself. But no, that's not what the New Testament teaches. But the New Testament does exalt him to a divine status, not as God himself, but as the Son of God, spotless without sin. No, please. The authors of the Talmud weren't trying to do that. Now, they might have had a bias in the other direction to the point where they wanted to demonize him even more than what, but it doesn't matter. Because they weren't out to sing his praises, it helps to balance out, you know, the other ridiculous side that wants to make him into a saint. And we discover, as I pointed out on previous shows, that a lot of these Talmudic references tell a consistent story with other extra biblical references, like, you know, non-canonized books, so that we can say, yeah, there probably is some truth to some of these accounts. They're worth taking into consideration, if nothing else. For example, you know, the Talmud talks about Jesus having had children with Mary Magdalene. Well, there's other sources that talk about that. Anyway, it's another story. There's talk of him having been the product of, you know, an adulterous affair that Mary had. Well, that's pretty goddamn obvious now, isn't it? Oh, no, he was born of a virgin. Oh, really? Well, tell me then, Bible dupe, why it is that neither Paul nor indeed any of the other apostles in all of their epistles ever even once so much as hint of at that concept. Never, ever, ever do they mention it. Ever. Isn't it amazing that the Christian world places so much on that doctrine? It is pivotal. And yet it's only mentioned once by Matthew and once by Luke. That's it. Of course, you know, the whole goddamn story, the whole damn book is a fairy tale. How could you possibly believe something like that anyway? But my point is, for those that accept that book as their authority, and yet that doctrine that is so pivotal to their faith is only mentioned once by Matthew, once by Luke. And when it's mentioned by Matthew, Matthew completely misquotes, completely distorts a passage from Isaiah, Isaiah 7:14, and gives it a meaning that Isaiah himself didn't give. That's pretty pathetic. And so you rest your doctrine, your pivotal doctrine, on that kind of a foundation. It's amazing, guys, how many multiplied millions, yea, billions of people down to the centuries have clung tenaciously to that doctrine. And there's nothing there, nothing, nothing. The whole thing is bullshit, but just that aspect of it, which can clearly be demonstrated to be a frickin' fraud, to be something that was added in later centuries and wasn't, an original part of the text. People are such suckers, man. Mindless idiots that just accept what they're told, never put it under the microscope, never subject it to close scrutiny, to critical analysis. There's a whole lot of things that people don't subject to critical analysis, and that's why we're in the screwed up mess that we're in. Anyway, not all the remains of Homo floresiensis were under 3 feet. As I said, in fact, the average height of this species was just under 4 feet. But, you know, you have the same thing today, right? You know, there are people that are, that span quite a range in height. The average height today is probably, what, 5 feet, 8 inches or whatever. But you have a lot of people that are 4 foot something, a lot of people that are 6 foot something. And so it was with these, with this species of pygmy. Some were as little as, 2 feet 11 inches or 2 feet 10 inches, I think was the shortest. Some were, almost 4 feet. But it doesn't matter. They were extremely short, much shorter than today's shortest pygmies. Makes you wonder, guys, what other variations of humans existed in ancient times that we don't know anything about, probably never will, because no remains of them have survived to our day, and no records of them in any other form have survived to our day. There are even some records of skulls that have been found with horns. In fact, I believe there's even a picture of at least one. I don't know where it's housed today. Now, is that authentic or is that something that was forged? Who knows? You always got to keep that in mind. There are some fake records, and there aren't many of these, many records, physical or literary or otherwise, of horned skulls, so, that doesn't rest on very solid ground. I wouldn't put too much stock in it. Maybe as a side note, a point of slight curiosity, but I wouldn't rest too much weight on that. But when it comes to the records of giants and pygmies, there's no question about that. There's been way too many finds, way too well documented by official sources, by the way. Not that you can always trust officialdom, very often you can't, but you understand my point. When you do have official records that talk about this, and now they're denying it, when their own records talk about it, we got a problem there, don't we? Anyway. So that concludes our discussion on giants and pygmies. Pretty interesting stuff. Just, another aspect to the bigger picture of how we're being lied to, all part of the awakening process. To me, it's not enough to know that our politicians are lying, that our religious leaders are lying, that our academic leaders. I want to know the whole story. It's not just enough to focus on science or history or politics or religion. I want the whole package. Too many people just, focus on, politics, let's say. They want to know the truth about that, and very often they don't even discover that. But How could, you know, how people could just want to limit themselves to just one area? Don't you want to know about everything? To know the truth about everything? To know if you're being lied to or not about this, that, or the other? I don't understand it. Anyway, so that completes that discussion. As to where to go next, there's several things I was considering. I guess it's been a while since I've done some Bible bashing, so why don't we take some time to do that? In fact, yeah, I'm going to do a three-part series here on that very topic. And the third one we'll discuss, which will probably take us into probably take us the rest of the week at least to cover these three sets of notes. The last one I'll cover, which won't be at least until probably Friday, if not Monday. I don't know. It depends how much I ramble, how much it takes to get through these notes. But the third one is going to be on John the Baptist. I was talking about maybe not doing that until next month or even July, because I did a Bible rant not too long ago, but it's been long enough. I think it's time again. As I said, this is a subject I got to return to again and again from time to time. Can't bash that damn book enough. It is so full of crap. And as I go along, guys, I find so many other problems. It's quite obvious that my goal of writing a book exposing the Bible, it's just not feasible anymore. I don't know how I'm going to do it. It's going to have to take several volumes, though. It just can't be done in one book. There's just way, way, way too much material to cover. And I don't want to leave anything out because there's just so much. So I'm going to probably have to do it in several volumes unless, you know, I have a book several thousand pages long. It's just not feasible. But literally, that's going to be what it's going to wind up being, is several thousand pages worth of, it's going to have more pages than the Bible itself. But anyway, the third topic I'm going to cover in this series is going to be on, the John the Baptist thing. And I'm trying to find where the hell I put this. Oh, yeah, here it is right here. I got it. I had a listener, that turned me on to this idea. I wasn't even familiar with it. Yeah, I did a whole show one time on John the Baptist, just covering the contradictions in the New Testament of his life story. Major freaking contradictions. You know, did he know Jesus was the Messiah when he baptized him or not? Did he believe that he was the Messiah later when he was in prison or not? You know, how could he have proclaimed him on the one hand as the Lamb of God that takes away the sins of the world when he baptized him, and then later when he's in prison, are you the one that is to come or do we look for another? He was supposed to be Jesus's cousin, knew him from the time he was a child. How could he not have believed in him as the Messiah later on in life? So, you know, I covered that before, but I never looked at it from the angle of John and Jesus having actually engaged in a war. And that, you know, they were battling it out behind the scenes, and that their followers showed loyalties strictly, you know, to their respective leader, in opposition against the other. I never realized that such a battle was going on, but there was, and it's very clearly portrayed in the New Testament. We're going to take a look at that. It's absolutely jaw-dropping. Here's another aspect to the John the Baptist story that eludes so many people. It eluded me until recently. So thanks to that listener that he sent me a bunch of notes, and I added a few other things of my own to it. It's very, very interesting. Anyway, I when he told me about it, we corresponded an email, and I mentioned to him that, you know, if he wanted, he could come on the show and we could talk about it together. And unfortunately, as often is the case, when that happens, I lose track of who sent me what. I don't even remember the guy's name or what his email was. And I don't save my emails. I just, my box gets too cluttered up. I delete them on a regular basis. I have to. It just gets overwhelming. I lost track of the guy's name and his email. I know he was from Australia. So anyway, if you're listening, drop me an email. Let me know. And, you know, we can get you on probably Friday's show. Or if you can't make that, you know, let me know. Maybe we can do it Monday or something. But I do want to talk about that as part of this series I'm going to begin now. I've been anxious to get to that for a while, actually. It's very, very, very good. Where do you see this, guys? This is just as good, if not better, than the discussion I did on the Apostle Paul and the fight that went on between him and James and Peter back in Jerusalem. There was a big, big schism, a big split that took place between the followers of Paul and the followers of the apostles that actually knew Christ. Big split. One group in Jerusalem was just following, you know, original Christianity, which was just nothing but Judaism that believed in Jesus. The other group, of course, led by Paul, was the more Gentilized version of Christianity, which rejected the old Judaic laws that James and Peter and John and the others didn't reject, were still, in fact, following, including, you know, circumcision, not eating with Gentiles, just eating with Jews, you know, on and on and on. Major, major schism, so much so that Paul was name-calling, and he felt that he could get away with that because he had a bigger following, you see. The Jerusalem believers didn't name-call. They were trying to keep peace, and they knew that Paul was a loose cannon. They didn't want to piss him off and get him to do something that might create a major scandal and, you know, maybe cause Christianity to collapse altogether or to bring more, you know, Roman fury down upon them. So they bit their tongue, whereas Paul was much more obnoxious, name-calling. "Those so-called pillars of the faith," he said. The obnoxious bastard, the arrogant bastard Paul, was actually dissing the original apostles that knew Jesus, calling them the so-called pillars, exalting himself as a higher authority when he never even met the great Jesus. And yet he's telling his leaders, "Listen to me, I know what I'm talking about. Don't listen to them guys." It's amazing. Bible dupes insist that all the Bible authors were in complete agreement with each other. They were all on the same page, all preaching the same message. Oh, bullshit they were. So anyway, you know, just like that set of notes I covered was just groundbreaking, jaw-dropping, showing this major battle that was going on. So it is in this set of notes, John the Baptist versus Jesus. Incredible. They were totally at odds with one another. I already had somewhat hinted at that. I just didn't realize how, you know, far it went at the time. But I talked a few weeks back about, you know, that alleged prophecy in Daniel 9. And then I went on to talk about how initially it appears that Jesus and John were both messianic figures, one serving as the royal bloodline Messiah, Jesus, and the other one, the priestly bloodline Messiah, John the Baptist. And that's what Jews of the first century were looking for. They were looking for two messiahs. And, you know, we quoted, for example, from the Dead Sea Scrolls that talked about that and how the priestly Messiah would assume preeminence over the kingly Messiah, and how that idea carried over into the Middle Ages, guys, where the popes claimed authority over the kings. There was your priestly bloodline once again, assuming power over the kingly bloodline. Nothing had changed over the centuries, had it? And that's why the third faction, you know, the secret societies and their banking system, stepped forward and said, screw you guys. You not only have made a mess of things the way you've run Europe, we're never going to have our Jew world order the way you guys are going. But you bicker back and forth so much. You're bringing attention to yourself, and you're going to cause the whole thing to collapse. We're taking over. You're not doing it right. We're going to strip both you guys of your power. Later, we might restore it to you, you know, if you learn to cooperate and if we can gain control enough over you so that we feel confident with allowing you to share in some of this power together with us. But right now, we're going to take down the control of both the church and the monarchs. That's exactly what happened. Anyway. But, yeah, so if you're listening out there, whatever your name was, I forget, from Australia, that gave me the idea initially for this John the Baptist show, drop me an email and, you know, I'll get you on. We can talk about these notes in the next day or two. You know, whatever day works for you. But I am going to be covering that, you know, in the next couple of days. Very interesting. It ranks right up there again with the notes I covered on Paul. Unbelievable, guys. Jesus and John the Baptist. This explains why there's so many contradictions in the story of John. A lot of times there's no explanation for the contradictions of the Bible other than the fact that it was just, you know, rewritten and re-edited so many times. Naturally, you're going to have, you know, conflicts for that reason. But in the case of John, it looks like the reason there's so many conflicting accounts about his life is because they were trying to hide the fact, and didn't do a very good job at it, but trying to hide the fact that there wasn't, you know, in fact, this debate, this fight that was going on between Jesus and his followers and John and his. But anyway, get into that later. But now let's look at what the Bible says about eunuchs. Very interesting story, as we'll see. All right, guys, short break. Let's be right back.
Buddy come from?
Well, little Jimmy, you see, the Jews print our money out of thin air and loan it back to us with interest, thus enslaving us through their usury.
Well, I never knew Jews were so good with money.
Yes, little Jimmy, that's why the Jews have been kicked out of over 109 places in 79 different countries for doing the same exact thing.
Wow. They certainly know how to parasite.
They sure do. That's why I bank with Shekelstein Credit Union. Shekelstein Credit Union, printing money out of thin air and enslaving the goyim since 1913. Shekelstein Credit Union. They sure know how to parasite.
Going! This is Renegade Broadcasting.
Guys, anyway, so let's get into this discussion on castration, or the act of becoming a eunuch, which was quite a popular practice among many different peoples in the ancient world, and the ancient Hebrews was certainly no exception, although it appears that for the most part, at least in the beginning, castration was something imposed upon them more often than a voluntary act. But as time went on, it seems that castration became accepted and was even popularized, particularly for fanatical religious reasons. When I say imposed on them, from outside. You know, when they fell into captivity. And you know, we'll get into that in a bit here. But you know, for example, you know, the Babylonians, when they brought them into captivity, they would castrate them. And there was good reason for that, in the ancient world, because it was known that castration caused men to be more passive. You know, they were more likely to be loyal, wouldn't be so resistant to taking orders and carrying them out, you know. So they would castrate them, make them more docile. And so that's what they would do when, you know, that's what they did with the Hebrews when they captured them. And they, you know, the ones that would serve in the royal court particularly. And it looks like what happened over time, because so many of them were castrated, maybe that's the solution to the problem. but anyway, it looks like, you know, this developed into a tradition, and they continued to practice it for religious reasons as time went on. We'll see how that appears to have mutated. Anyway, let's look at a brief overview of the subject. There were three different types of eunuchs in biblical times. Those who just had their testicles removed, those who just had their penis removed, and then those who had both testicles and penis removed. The Bruce Jenner syndrome. Interesting topic for what we see going on around us, isn't it? Very fitting. The whole transgender thing, guys, is, you know, ties right in with that, doesn't it? So it looks like they're trying to bring back their old favorite little practice, just like, you know, they've got circumcision commonly practiced now in this country and so many others abroad, you know, as routine. What is it really? It's their tribal little mark, their little fingerprint. They get everybody doing it. Now they're trying to get everybody to practice castration, something that became very popular among them. There's other twisted reasons for them pushing this as well, but, you know, there's one possible reason for it right there. Anyway, as I said, initially eunuchs were made this way by force, since this practice renders its victims, you know, docile and thus more easily controlled. It was a common practice for ancient rulers to castrate some of their servants and or advisors for these very reasons, make them docile, more controllable. Ultimately, as this practice became more routine and thus normalized, it began to be observed, you know, voluntarily, especially when the idea was sold to them that this is what Yahweh desired. As we'll see later in the New Testament, Jesus himself endorsed the idea. But let's look at some examples of castration, starting with the Old Testament. Isaiah 39, verse 7 says, "And of thy sons that shall issue from thee, which thou shalt beget, shall they take away, and they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon." This is the great Yah telling his chosen ones what they were in store for. The king is going to take many of you away, and you're going to be made eunuchs. Funny, you know, the great Yah doesn't condemn the idea. He doesn't say, "Don't worry, they're going to try to make you eunuchs, but I'm not going to let them do it." Nope, nope, no voice of condemnation here at all. The great Yah seems to have been all for it. Daniel 1:3 says, "And the king spoke unto Aspenaz, the master of his eunuchs, that he should bring certain of the children of Israel and of the king's seed and of the princes." Then in verse 7 we read, verses 7 and 8, "unto whom the prince of the eunuchs gave names, for he gave unto Daniel the name of Belteshazzar, and to Hananiah of Shadrach, and to Mishael of Meshach, and to Azariah of Abednego." These are Daniel's three friends. Both Daniel and his three friends were all given new names. And they were castrated, just like we read from Isaiah a moment ago. "You'll be taken into captivity to Babylon, and they will castrate you." That's exactly what happened. Daniel and his three friends had no balls, ladies and gentlemen. They were castrated. The passage goes on, "But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's meat, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore, he requested of the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself." Notice, Daniel had to get permission from who? The prince of the eunuchs. Why? Because he was a eunuch himself. Notice, though, it says Daniel didn't want to defile himself with the king's meat. In this context, the word meat simply means food. He didn't want to eat the king's food, only the kosher food. Somebody in an email last week made an interesting comment. Probably the best way to ensure that we're getting food that's, you know, not toxic for us is to buy kosher. It's probably true. In fact, it is true, isn't it? Shop in the kosher section. It's made for them. They're not going to put their toxins in there, guys. You won't find, you know, chemical ingredients that you can't pronounce in any of that food. That's probably some good advice. Just make sure you put your yarmulke on when you buy it, because, you know, probably inject it with something as you're checking out. Anyway, here we see that Daniel, if he ever even was a real historical figure, was apparently made a eunuch when he was brought as a captive to Babylon. In fact, Josephus tells us that Daniel was indeed a eunuch. Anyway, Daniel 1:9 says, now God had brought Daniel into favor and tender love with the prince of the eunuchs. Now, wait just a minute. When I was putting these notes together last week, I don't ever remember reading that. Isn't that a kick in the jaw? Daniel was brought into tender love with the prince of the eunuchs. Yeah. Oh, yeah. How do you like that one, Bible dupes? Your great hero, Daniel, had a tender, loving relationship with the prince of the eunuchs. This prince of the eunuchs obviously was a eunuch himself. He was appointed, though, as the prince, the overseer, who was answerable directly to the king, who gave the king's orders to the eunuchs. Daniel, you know, was answerable to him. Although we're told later, Daniel was made, you know, second highest in the kingdom next to the king, probably because he too entered into tender love with the king. Who knows? But nevertheless, I mean, how else are you to interpret that? Pretty bizarre. Anyway, here's yet some more references to eunuchs in the Bible. Oh, this is a good one. Esther, the little bitch. Esther 4, verses 4 and 5 says, when Esther's eunuchs and female attendants came and told her about Mordecai, she was in great distress. She sent clothes for him to put on instead of his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. Then Esther summoned Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs assigned to attend her, and ordered him to find out what was troubling Mordecai and why. So notice, Esther had at her disposal a number of eunuchs, her little errand boys. You know, again, as to whether or not she really existed, who knows? But if she did, look what it says about her here. She was, you know, she had all of these eunuch little lap dogs, emasculated males, little drone eunuchs that bowed to her every whim. Anyway, in the following four passages, we discover that eunuchs had become quite a common feature within the borders of ancient Israel. Jeremiah 29:2, for example, says, after that, Jeremiah, the king and queen, and the eunuchs, the princes of Judah and Jerusalem, and the carpenters and the smiths were departed from Jerusalem. Notice here, the impression is given in this passage now that eunuchs were a common thing within the tribe. It started out, you know, it was something that just took place when they were taken into captivity. But now here, within Jerusalem itself, we're told that there were a great many eunuchs. Jeremiah 34:19 says, the princes of Judah and the princes of Jerusalem, the eunuchs and the priests and all the people of the land, blah, 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 blah. Here again, we see eunuchs mentioned as, you know, a fairly large group. Were they eunuchs because they previously were made such forcefully while in captivity? Or, you know, were they eunuchs voluntarily for religious reasons? Probably a combination of the two. But clearly, what was once frowned upon and dreaded as something that was imposed upon them when they were taken into captivity eventually became a common practice and was done for religious reasons. Maybe the ones who had already been forcefully made eunuchs wanted to impose that on others because they were stuck with that for life and didn't want to be the only ones that had to suffer and didn't want to be teased about it, right?
Who are you? We're not listening to you, Mr. No Balls.
So you can just imagine them wanting to inflict that on others, right? Making it a religious requirement.
No, you have to because God said so.
Whatever the reason, it did become a common practice among them. Like I said, by the time the great Jesus came along, yeah, it was common. The great Jesus himself said to do it, didn't he? We'll look at that passage again later for those that haven't heard it before. Jeremiah 38:7 is another example. Now, when Abimelech, the Ethiopian, one of the eunuchs which was in the king's house, heard that they had put Jeremiah in the dungeon, the king then sitting in the gate of Benjamin, blah, 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 blah. Here we see that by this time, the Hebrew kings or the local tribal chieftains also required his subjects, his royal court officials, to be castrated. By this time now, this is something that they required as well, following along with what, you know, other kings did in their era. Plagiarizing, in other words. And eventually this plagiarized pagan practice became sanctified as a Yahwehian command. Jeremiah 41:16 is another passage along this line. Then took Johanan, the son of Kareah, and all the captains of the forces that were with him, all the remnant of the people whom he had recovered from Ishmael, the son of Nethaniah, from Mizpah. After that, he had slain Goliath, the son of Jediah, however the hell you pronounce that. Anyway, even mighty men of war, and the women, and the children, and the eunuchs whom he had brought again from Gibeon. So here we again have reference to eunuchs as being, you know, a fairly large percentage of the population numbered amongst the heebie-jeebies. So that, you know, this was a common practice by this time. Again, some of them probably had it imposed on them when they were in captivity. Others did it voluntarily or were coerced into doing it, having them been led to believe that that it was Yahweh's will. Anyway. But, you know, it's clear why they adopted it. They realized, yeah, hey, we can control our minions too. Just as the heathen kings that took us into captivity were able to do, we can control our minions the same way. So let's have it required as well. And then eventually, yeah, they added the religious connotation because that made it more acceptable. This practice had grown so popular among the Hebrews that it was decided that their God would not speak a word against it. And so he never did. Not only did he not speak against it, but again, you know, there's many passages that imply that he was all for it. For example, Isaiah 56 verses 4 and 5 says, "For this is what the Lord says to the eunuchs who keep my Sabbaths, who choose what pleases me and holds fast to my covenant. To them I will give within my temple and its walls a memorial and a name better than sons and daughters. I will give them an everlasting name that will endure forever." So here's Yah saying that he accepts the eunuchs now. They're just as important to him as all of his other little chosenites. Never a word on the part of this great fire-breathing dragon against the practice of eunuchism. That's probably a new word I just invented, but comes in handy. He never spoke against castration, ladies and gentlemen. Far from it, he said, "Yay, I will accept you now, like all my other chosenites." So there you go. Great Yah was all for castration. What other conclusion can you draw? He never spoke against it. Just like slavery, he never spoke against it, guys. The only time he had an aversion to it, he never condemned the practice, though. Never came out and said, don't practice slavery. It's an abomination. In fact, later he gave instruction about slavery, didn't he? He told them not to enslave your fellow Chosenites, but if you do, that to be released, you know, after the seventh year. But Gentiles you may enslave for life. They shall be your property. So far from speaking against slavery, he actually embraced it, endorsed it, sanctioned it, didn't he? And so it is here with castration. Which is pretty interesting because, again, I'm getting ahead of myself, but this passage is where the great Yah forbade anybody to come into his holy sanctuary that didn't have danglers between their legs or that didn't mutilate, you know, in any way their sex organs. And yet he commanded circumcision, didn't he? What the Christ is going on here? What a frickin' monkey rig mess the whole damn thing is. Anyway, here it is. In this ridiculous book of nonsensical, colossal contradictions, we find the great Yah saying this in Deuteronomy 23:1. If a man's testicles are crushed or his penis is cut off, he may not be admitted to the assembly of the Lord. But it was okay to have his foreskin chopped off. No problem with that. But his testicles must not be crushed. Guys, no putting your testicles in the vise anymore, or Yahweh will not accept you into his assembly. Recognizing what a demon bastard Yahweh is, maybe you should put your testicles in a vise. I don't personally advise it, but, you know, do it just to piss him off. And to make sure you don't get accepted into his assembly. So here's the deal. You couldn't wedge your testicles into a vise, nor could you chop your little wee-wee off. So sorry, Bruce Jenner, but you can't get accepted into the congregation of the Lord. That really sucks, doesn't it? Yeah, too late for you. So you couldn't chop your wangy off or put your testicles in a vise, but you could chop off your foreskin, and that was okay, apparently. How in the world could he say, on the one hand, you know, don't mutilate your gonads, but yet, if you mutilate them the way I tell you, well, that's okay. Just like he says, thou shalt not kill, but yet commands killing all over the goddamn place, and you better do it or else, when I tell you. Later, David is rebuked by the great Yah, who tells him, you have shed innocent blood. He actually says that. He's pissed off with David because he shed innocent blood. And yet another passage is he's commanding David and everybody else, you know, to go kill little infants. Kill infants, young suckling infants. He says it many, many times. And yet he condemns David for shedding innocent blood. Woo! You gotta love that hypocrisy of the great Yah Yah. Anyway, but you know, you got to wonder, did Yahweh accept or reject castration? Here he says, don't put your testicles in a vise, don't chop your wangy off, but he obviously accepted castration, didn't he? Those who keep my Sabbaths will be my sons, and you know, the eunuchs who keep my Sabbaths will be my sons, you know, blah, 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 blah. But yet he said, if you chop the damn thing off, you can't enter into my congregation. Do you see how they just kept inventing and reinventing this religion as they went along, guys? It's obvious. Yet Bible dupes once again think that this is inspired of God, an infallible God. This book is infallible. It couldn't possibly contradict itself. What the hell do you think it's doing here?
If you chop off your penis, you won't be accepted into my congregation. And then later, the eunuchs will be accepted. What the frickin' hell is going on here? Anyway, here it is. The passage I made reference to about Christ earlier. Matthew 19:12. Here it is. For those that didn't catch this a while back when I covered this, when I cited this in a different context. Here's the great Jesus talking here. He says, for there are some eunuchs which were so from their mother's womb. You know, men born without a penis or a mutilated penis, whatever, you know, hermaphrodite or whatever the frig. And then there are some eunuchs or born without testicle, whatever. I guess that does happen. And there are some eunuchs which were made eunuchs of men. And there be eunuchs which have made themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. He that is able to receive it, let him receive it. Can you believe this? Far from being against this horrific practice of self-mutilation, Jesus is all for it. If you're able to do it, hey, go for it, for the kingdom of heaven's sake. Unbelievable. Unbelievable, guys. The Bible, speaks against mutilating yourself, you know, getting a tattoo or, putting ear spools in your ears and stretching out your earlobes. You know, it's all against self-mutilation, supposedly, right? But yet, chop off your foreskin or the whole wee-wee, for that matter, for the kingdom of heaven's sake, or at least your danglers anyway. Chop them off. Jesus was all for it. You can't say that, well, that was just, a lot of Christians will do that. That was just an Old Testament practice, but things changed with the New Testament. As though, you know, the New Testament era, the religion of Christianity was so much superior to anything in the Old Testament. Well, sorry. You can't make that claim here now, can you? The great Jesus was all for. In fact, this is the most clear statement in favor of castration in the entire Bible. And it's in the New Testament from the mouth of the great Jesus himself, totally endorsing castration, ladies and gentlemen. You can't say that was just a primitive, archaic practice in the Old Testament. Your great Jesus endorsed it right here. This is another example, guys, of one of those passages where single-handedly this passage destroys the whole Christian religion right here. For Bible dupes to make the claim that Jesus was so wise, so loving, so wonderful, so superior to all other huckster religious leaders, that he was the only true, genuine one that we should be following. What do you do with that? Dumbasses. You want to follow someone like that that makes a statement like that? Are you daft? All right, guys, short break right back.
Okay, little Jimmy, as a 4-year-old child, I trust your judgment to make life-altering decisions about your body and gender. But where can I get some help for this?
But we can help. Here at the Michelle Obama Academy for Transgender Children, we will convince you and your child that gender is just a social construct. Bruce Jenner knows that just because you were born with a penis, that doesn't mean you need to be a boy. It means that you need to chop it off and get a neo-vagina. At Michelle Obama's Academy for Transgender Kids, we know the importance of chopping off genitals.
Guys, welcome back. Anyway, boy, how fitting that that commercial happened to run at this time. Perhaps they should change it from the Michelle Academy, Michelle Obama Academy, really Michael Obama, to the Jesus Academy for Transgender Children. The Jesus Academy. Because he was all for chopping off genitals himself now, wasn't he? He was. Maybe Jesus was a transgender, too. He who can receive it, let him receive it for the kingdom of heaven's sake. Maybe that's why, if in fact he lived a sinless life and never whacked his little pee-pee or had a wet dream. Maybe that's why. Maybe he had no gonads at all and thus had no sex drive or the ability to do anything about it if he did. Although I doubt it because we have so many references to him having homosexual relations with his disciples. He liked to be with Peter alone in the garden with Peter being naked. So I think he had his package in full order. But anyway, nevertheless, guys, he was all for chopping off your wee-wee. You gotta love it. The great Jesus wants you to get your gonads chopped off. It's a good thing. Here we have the completion of the transition from castration initially being something frowned upon as something bad to now being looked at as something, you know, good and wholesome, something to be desired. We saw how in the book of Isaiah, Yahweh now was saying, oh, it's okay. I accept the eunuchs now who come to me. Before he said, if you chop off your wangy, you can't enter my congregation, right? Now we see him accepting it. Yeah, I'll accept you as my sons, you eunuchs. Now, though, the completion of this transition occurs with Jesus actually saying that you should do it. Not just that if you already have it done, I'll accept you. No, now he's saying to do it. Jesus completes that transition. You don't even have a statement that clear in the New Testament. I mean, in the Old Testament. You do now in the New Testament by Jesus himself. Unbelievable, guys. And, you know, no wonder they're pushing the transgender theme, guys. If for no other reason, and there are others, of course, sure. They want to demoralize you and screw you up so you don't know which way is up, down, back, front, left, right, male, female. But they also know that it produces docile, more easily moldable minions. So they're testing the waters. They want to see how much they can popularize the transgender thing. It's also good population control, too. You've got to add that in there. You know, you get your wangy chopped off, or, you know, you if you're a female wanting to become a male, you get your hormones so screwed up, you're not going to be able to have a baby. In fact, you know, your vagina gets transformed into a wangy. You got your little joystick there hanging. Now you're not able to have a baby anymore. So whether you're a male or female, to go through the transgender operation, you are now sterile, aren't you? Great for decreasing the population. There's multiple reasons for them doing this, but it also makes you more docile, too. Well, at least it makes men docile. Transgender females are pretty scary. They're more masculine than a lot of the men I know. Doesn't make them docile, but nevertheless, I just look at Hillary Clinton. Look at goddamn Janet Reno. Oh, Jesus Christ, can't get more masculine than that. But as far as the men go, yeah, it does make them more docile, more, you know, moldable, less likely to rise up. The modern militant transgender theme is not just about confusing, degrading, and demoralizing society, folks. It's about goddamn mind control. And so here they are pushing this age-old castration / eunuch theme once again, aren't they? And once again, the great Jesus was all for it. I'm surprised the Christian world frowns upon the transgender theme the way it does. I really am. Your Jesus was all for it. Chop your wangy off. Oh, wait. He didn't say get a vagina. Just chop it off. So apparently, you have to be sexless the rest of your life. Nevertheless, guys, there should be a lot of Christians out there. You know, a lot of men who have no qualms with using the ladies' room because they don't use a urinal. Why aren't they for chopping off their wangy? You know, if you're supposed to be all for following whatever Jesus said, right? There should be a lot of street people, too, Christian street people out there. Jesus said, sell everything you have, give the poor, come follow me. How come Christians aren't following that? You got to love it once again, how they're so selective in what they choose to follow. That in and of itself is an admission that a lot of what Jesus taught is absolute horseshit. The very fact that they don't even follow a good deal of what he said. They don't. If you really believe in the great Jesus like you claim, now there's something to throw at these obnoxious, finger-pointing, judgmental Christian bastards and bitches. You know, tell them, until you chop off your genitals, I don't want to hear anything from you and your hypocritical finger-pointing. Anyway, interestingly, as is so often the case with the Apostle Paul, he actually contradicted the great Jesus in this respect, as he did in a lot of others as well. Whereas Christ commanded castration in order to rise above the evil temptation to have sex, Paul simply said to either remain celibate or else get married, as we see in the following passage. Jesus said get castrated to avoid the pitfall of sinful temptations to have sex. Paul said, nope, if you can't overcome the temptation, then simply get married. Here's what he said in 1 Corinthians 7:7-9. I wish that all of you were as I am, meaning unmarried. Now, to the unmarried and to the widows, I say, it is good for them to stay unmarried as I do. But if they cannot control themselves, they should marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion, you know, to burn with lust. Because if you do that, you might actually wind up playing with your pee-pee. You're not supposed to do that. You're only to use that to urinate with. That's it. But notice, Jesus' solution to that problem,
so you're not tempted to whack your little pee-pee, and certainly so that you don't have sex with other people. Oh, my God! You know, chop it off was the solution Jesus gave. Paul didn't say anything about that, did he? Of course, you know, Paul was getting his on the side, you know, as is the case with most men of the cloth down through the ages. They're not celibate. They just want you to be. So that you think that they're so holy and exalted above you. They're above these baser human elements of the sex drive. Why? We don't have that. Or else we do, but we have conquered it. It doesn't tempt us anymore. Yeah, right. Yeah, what a bunch of horseshit that is. Jesus Christ, man. So many Catholics look up to their priests like they're so exalted. They've given their lives to God so much that, you know, the sex drive doesn't tempt them. They've overcome it. Ah, frig. Anyway, but just stop and consider this lame advice Paul gave for a moment. Jesus' advice, of course, is extremely lame too. Chop off your gonads. But listen to what Paul is saying. It's good that Paul isn't endorsing castration, but check out how he advocates getting married simply to alleviate sexual tensions. God damn it, guys. Once again, look at what horseshit this frigged up religion is. This book is so completely and hopelessly frickin' messed up, man. So full of shit. Paul is saying here that you should get married simply because you can't avoid touching your wee-wee. You know, if you can't get over the horniness of it all and stop touching your wee-wee, or if you're just having naughty, wet dreams, you wake up with crusty underwear every morning, then get married so you won't burn with lust and passion. Get married for that reason. That's what he's saying. A book that prides itself in supposedly being a guide to love, to genuine human love, to godly love, tells you to get married so you won't burn with lust and whack your willy. Jesus, goddamn, unfrickin' believable. Anyway, that completes that discussion. Oh, we'll definitely get to the Jesus and John the Baptist battle before Friday. We might wind up getting into that tomorrow. So, yeah, if you're listening, listener from Australia, I forget your name, but, drop me an email, and if you want, you can get me on the show, you know, tomorrow, in fact, if you want. But I'm definitely going to be covering that probably tomorrow, certainly by Friday. But before that, let's talk now about, and this will definitely take us into tomorrow's show. I won't finish this in 15 minutes. But, Gentiles, the mention of Gentiles in the Bible. I certainly talked about, you know, several passages that mention Gentiles in a not too good light in the past, but I've never done a show putting all of these passages together. And of course, there's a lot of stuff in here that I haven't talked about before. So yeah, it's very telling to see what the Bible, you know, to put all these passages together collectively, then step back, look at the big panoramic picture. The Bible has a lot of derogatory statements about Gentiles, ladies and gentlemen, which really serves as the framework, the foundation of the idea of Jewish supremacism. It stems from this damn book. It didn't come originally from the Talmud, didn't come originally from the Kabbalah. It comes from this goddamn book. The whole idea of Jewish supremacism originates here. The idea that they're the chosen, the special, the favored,
not only are they exalted as special in that damn book, but Gentiles are crushed, pulverized under their feet, in the language that's used, the language used by the great Yah himself. So Jews are exalted, Gentiles are debased. And when you see that, how in the world you, as a Gentile, can make love to this book the way that so many do is just absolutely freaking mind-blowing. A book that trashes you in the dust while exalting the Chosenites. How in the world you could embrace such a book and think that it was written for you, that it has a message for you, a good, oh, it's got a message for you, all right, but not a good one. Want to understand their psychopathic mentality and where it comes from? Well, there's no better place to look. So let's do that, shall we? The word Gentile first appears in the first book of that collection of nonsensical books called Genesis. Right in the story of... right after the story of the flood in chapter 10, verse 5. This was supposedly a time long before the word Jew itself was ever even heard of, supposedly. And that's interesting because, again, Gentile is supposed to mean, the opposite of Jew, or it's supposed to be all the other people other than the Jews. So why is the word Gentile even mentioned in the book of Genesis at a time long before the word Jew was even in use? You see my point? It's very interesting. But anyway, what this verse is designed to make its fans believe is that God began to make a distinction from very early on between his favored chosen ones, or, the Shemites or Semites, and the rest of humanity, the pagans, the heathens, the sinners, the Gentiles. So anyway, this distinction can be found all throughout the rest of the Bible. Literally, the Gentiles are always portrayed as evil, vile, wretched, defiling, as well as defiled. Just having contact with them, giving heed to their evil teachings and practices will corrupt and pervert you. I want to keep you pure and have you go out and murder little infants. And all the while, of course, the Chosenites are portrayed as Yahweh's little pets. The only time the Chosen Ones are not portrayed as such is when they aren't bowing to and kissing the hind parts of the great Yah. Other than that, they're his special Chosen Ones, and everyone else, everybody, is vile and evil. They're lost. They're hellbound. But even then, even when he's rebuking them, they're still considered to be above all other peoples. And of course, isn't this what the Talmud teaches? It just takes this theme and runs off with it. But it originates with this book. Anyway, let's take a look at some of the many derogatory references the Gentiles in this book of nonsense. Let's look at Psalm 2, verses 1 and 2, for example, which says, "Why do the nations, or Gentiles, conspire and the peoples plot in vain?" Oh, gee, who conspires? "The kings of the earth rise up and the rulers band together against the Lord and against his anointed," meaning his tribe. They rise up and conspire against the tribe? Really? Really? Can you frickin' believe this, guys? Who's been the conspirers against who down through the centuries? God damn it, man. This was designed for the few stragglers out there, you know, within the tribe that might not know what's going on, to instill in them the idea that even if you don't like what you see amongst your elites that are conspiring against the Goy masses, you need to join with them because that's what they're doing against you. You see what's going on here? They're conspiring against you, so you have to join with our conspiracy because it's really nothing but a counter-conspiracy. That's what this verse is saying. Unbelievable, man. And, you know, isn't this the claim they make today? And why they got to push, you know, anti-hate laws. They got everybody, or most everybody, believing that, you know, everyone's out to get them. And when there aren't anyone, when there isn't anyone picking on them, they'll do it themselves, right? How many times you've seen this where Jewish students are caught spray painting, you know, their dorm room doors or walls, you know, with anti-Semitic slogans. They're doing it themselves. They go into their own cemeteries and spray paint, you know, stones there. Oh, if I had a dime for every time I've seen an article, guys, you know, talking about that. And here it is, the Not-So-Holy Book itself doing the same thing. Where does this idea originate, making themselves out to look like victims when they're the victimizers, and making their victims out to look like they're the victimizers? Jesus Christ, it started with this book, God damn it. Here's another reference from Psalm 9, verse 20. Strike them with terror, Lord, David is pleading here. Let the nations, the Gentiles, know that they are only mortal. Strike them with terror. Look at all these derogatory references to Gentiles. They're vulgar, they're unclean, they're conspirers. What group of people is and ever has been the master of terrorism through the ages, ladies and gentlemen? And yet here, David is pleading with the great Yah, strike them with terror, Lord. Let the nations know that they are only mortal. Humble them in the dust. Strike them with terror. They don't need to pray to their Yah to strike with terror. They're the ones, ladies and gentlemen, behind the world's terror, aren't they? They've always had the attitude that Gentiles are the little playthings, a lower form of life to be manipulated at will through fear. And where does this attitude come from? Again, the Bible. Here's another one, Psalm 22:28. For dominion belongs to the Lord, and he rules over the nations. Again, the Gentiles. Dominion belongs to the Lord. What do they mean when they say that? It belongs to them, the people of the Lord. Dominion belongs to the Lord, and he rules over the nations, the Gentiles. It's our place to rule. This has always been their attitude. Anyway, here's some more passage along this line. Isaiah 60, verse 3, and then verses 13 and 14 says, I've read these numerous times in the past, but here it is again in this context. Look at the attitude here of the tribe toward the Gentiles, toward the nations. And only then can you really put into perspective what we're seeing playing out right now before our eyes, guys, the push for the Jew World Order. It all originated in this goddamnable book. And the Gentiles shall come to thy light, and kings to the brightness of thy rising. The glory of Lebanon shall come unto thee, the fir tree, the pine tree, and the box elder together, to beautify the place of my sanctuary, says the Lord, and I will make the place of my feet glorious. The sons also of them that afflicted thee shall come bending unto thee, bowing, you know, at the knee. And all they that despised thee shall bow themselves down at the soles of thy feet, and they shall call thee the city of the Lord, the Zion of the Holy One of Israel. There's your real Zionism right there, ladies and gentlemen. All the nations, all the Gentiles will bow at the soles of thy feet. Look at the attitude this book has toward Gentiles. And you mindless Gentile fools out there that suck up this book on a daily basis, do you have even the slightest clue what the hell you're doing? You'd better catch on and fast. Psalm 47:4 says, He, Yahweh, shall subdue the people under us and the nations, the Gentiles, under our feet. Isaiah 45:14, And they, the Gentiles, shall be yours, Israel. They shall come after you in chains. They shall come over, and they shall fall down unto thee in chains. Well, we're pretty much in chains right now, aren't we? Isaiah 49:23 says, They shall bow down to thee with their face toward the earth and lick up the dust of thy feet. The Gentiles. Isaiah 60 verse 5. Ye shall also suck the milk of the Gentiles and shall suck the breasts of kings. In other words, you got a parasite off of them. Ooh, look where we're at today. Guys, the whole philosophy comes from this goddamn detestable piece of literary shit. All right, guys, pick up the animal. Take care. My body started shaking and I can't take no more.
If you enjoy listening to Renegade Broadcasting, but are not also reading Renegade Tribune, you're missing out. We have some of the most insightful and hard-hitting authors from the past and present, covering some of the most taboo and controversial subjects. The Tribune is something you'll want to check out every single day. Perhaps you have what it takes to be an author. Sign up and submit your piece. Join us at RenegadeTribune.com.